read in our holy book. The Lord said unto Moses, write it for a memorial in the book, rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. When the children of Israel escaped into the wilderness, the Amalekites were the first of the desert folk with whom they came into contact. The Hebrews petitioned peacefully for water, for rites of passage. The Amalekites responded with an unprovoked attack upon the Israelite baggage train and upon the women and children. And he smote thee upon the hindmost part against the enfeebled and the frail when thou wast weary, and he feared not God. Now there are those who are spiritually romantic who blanch at this command in our Bible to be eternally vigilant against neighbors, neighboring nations which have done harm to you. Zachor et asher asa lecha Amalek, al tishkach. Remember what Amalek did unto you, thou shalt not forget. These romantics, I'm afraid, confuse religion with an unworldly innocence, and morality with a boundless ability, to the boundless tolerance of suffering and of anguish. They live with the unsupported hope that somehow the tears and the silent suffering of the decent will elicit the goodness of the ruthless, the callous, and of the cruel. They believe that patience and acquiescence are the supreme and ultimate virtues, and indeed that these are the ultimate weapons against evil. But forgiveness, dear friends, is of God, not of man. Passivity often only brings out the cruelty and the violence of men. They feel their power over you. They dig into you. They draw out from you blood and worse. Now, of course, it is foolish and worse to build walls against one's family and against one's neighbors because we nurse a petty grudge, because we have a bruised ego. But I submit that it is foolish and worse to accept as face value the simple words spoke trippingly at the end of the tongue, I am sorry. Words are so easily spoken, and a change of heart, a change of opinion, a new conscience, a new character is awfully hard to come by. And when a man or a nation has again and again proven to you that he has a basic disregard of the ultimate values of civilized life, then I submit, be on your guard. Be cautious. Wary. Zachor et asher asa lecha Amalek, al tishkach. Remember what Amalek did unto you, thou shalt not forget it. Now this caution appears in the book of Deuteronomy, and it was not set down after this one dastardly attack upon the women and children in the desert. The book of Judges tells us that over some 300 years, these Amalekites incessantly raided the Hebrew settlements and devastated the fields and carried off booty and plunder. These were desert pirates, men who lived by the sword and by violence, and for over 300 years they disrupted the peace of the Israelite community. So Saul, early on in his reign, captured the Amalekite king Agag, and David later decimated the Amalekite forces in a decisive battle. Zechor et Amalek. Remember, Amalek is the caution. Be wary of those who have proven their selfishness and their ruthlessness, their lack of compassion, and their lack of concern for the rights and the freedoms of others. Now, in rabbinic literature, Amalek became symbol of all the cruel, indefatigable, and implacable enemies of Israel. Amalek was Rome. Amalek was the Rome that crushed Jewish independence. Amalek was the Rome that trod Jewish sensitivities under its iron boot. Amalek was the Rome that refused to allow our sages to teach our congregations to meet or our people to respond to the decencies and of their tradition. And in the Middle Ages, Amalek was the church militant, the church which ordered the Jew badge, the church which made it a point of its theology that the Jew was perfidious and untrustworthy, and that he was living in a degradation which he merited. The church whose pastors, again and again on a Sunday morning, encouraged their congregations to a happy Sunday outing of looting and of bloodletting in the ghetto. And in later times, Amalek was Germany. The Germany of the blood libel, of the pogrom, the Germany of cultivated anti-Semitism and of deliberate social and professional ostracism, the Germany of Dachau, the Germany of Meidenbeck, the Germany which cried out, Jüda verreck, let the Jew perish. Over the flame which has been lit in Paris to the 6 million Jewish martyrs of the Hitler Holocaust, you will see inscribed the simple Hebrew words, Zachor et Amalek. Remember Amalek. Now there are those among us who say, the past is over and done. Hitler is dead. The Nazi criminals have been caught, tried, and punished, or they're being searched down. History cannot be undone. Why not accept the German protestations of a change of heart and the reparations money at their face value? Wipe the slate clean. And there are those who say that, after all, Hitler was an aberration. The Nazi period was one of temporary national insanity. The crushing defeat of 1944 and 1945 has finally shaken the Germans awake. They've come alive to their innate decency. Fortunately, German history cannot be read in such a simple line. Read the history of the Jews and of Germany. It's a history that reaches back deep into Roman times. The first settlement of Jews in Germany was in Cologne in the year 321. Read that history, and you will see it as a sad chronicle, a bittersweet chronicle, with successive economic restrictions, political oppressions, anti-Jewish feelings, and periodic bloodletting. Hitler cannot be ticked off simply as an aberration, a madness which seized the people, from which they have now been freed. Our tradition emphasizes the need for wariness and for caution by reminding us that King Saul impulsively, with all the good intentions of the world, spared the life of the Amalekite king whom he captured, Agag. And Agag was destined to be the direct lineal descendant of Haman, the Agagite. Haman the first, who plotted the utter extinction of the Jewish people. When we forget too easily, though we have defeated for the moment the policies of hate, we forget that the poisons of hate go underground into the subterranean recesses of the soul, where they course for generation after generation, until a more propitious time arises, when violence again becomes national policy, hate the rallying cry of a people. Prejudice may disappear from public view, but it may also reappear, and often after the hiatus, the jump of a generation or more. On the Sabbath before Purim, on the Sabbath before the holy day where we retell the connivings of Haman, we are told to read in our synagogues, Zachor et Amalek. For it is the sad experience of our people that we forget too easily, that we lower our guard, that we seek to be cautious, and that an Agag gives birth to a Haman, that a Germany of Kaiser Wilhelm gives birth to the Germany of Hitler. Poisons of hate rise again in the human soul, for they have never been fully erased. The words of hate have been spoken in the cradle, and in the family circle, and in the office, in the social grouping. Though they have not been in public view, they have not ceased to be. Zachor et Amalek. Remember Amalek. Thou shalt not forget. This week, a one-time and a long-time Nazi, Kurt George Kiesinger, is nominated and elected as the Chancellor of the Federal Republic of West Germany. Kiesinger joined the Nazi Party in 1932, rather early on in the game. Kiesinger remained a member of the Nazi Party until Hitler's defeat. Though he seems to have lost faith in the Führer during the last years of the war, when the tide of battle was turning against Germany. A denazification proceeding has held Kiesinger blameless of any overt, actual, physical act of violence or murder, any criminal act against the Jews. Now, Kiesinger's election has been justified by Bonn to the world with the following official explanation. Yes, there were terrible crimes committed during the Hitler era, but these were committed by toughs and hooligans and criminals. Not all Germans were implicated, and not all Nazis were implicated. Only the men who have actually blood on their hands are guilty, and these we are ferreting out and bringing to justice. The German ambassador to the United States, Heinrich Knapstein, recently reviewed this official logic and added an explanation to it. Let me read it. Quote, I would like to deal with a question often asked in this country. Speaking of the United States. How is it possible that so many former Nazis are still in office, sometimes even in high office? To this question, we have a realistic approach. A real Nazi, we would consider a person who was an active promoter of Nazism, or worse, who had committed crimes out of such motives. A man who joined the Nazi Party only because of the pressure typical of every totalitarian regime, might have been an opportunist or politically not very intelligent. But if he had never actively furthered the cause of Nazism or committed crimes, we call him a Mitlaufer, a follower, or a nominal party member, but not a Nazi. More than 7 million people were Nazi party members, of whom a relatively small percentage were Nazis in the sense I have described. Thus it was decided after the war that we had to grant, quote, the right of political error, unquote, to nominal party members and keep them in their jobs. End of Mr. Kiesinger. Now the new German Chancellor, by the testimony of his own ambassador to Washington, is either an opportunist or politically not very intelligent. And I submit that none of these qualities would lead one to repose much faith in his leadership of the German Republic. And as one who does remember Amalek, I must say that I am not impressed with this logic. For there are many levels of guilt and many shadings and degrees of responsibility. And no German, and especially no Nazi, can hold out his hands and say, Naki kapayim uvar levav, I am clean of hands, innocent, and of a pure heart. I'd remind you that from 1932, when Herr Kiesinger joined the Nazi Party, until 1938, when the first mass deportations began, so much happened within the sight and the hearing of all Germans that none can say, I did not see, I did not hear, I did not know. Day after day, Jews going about their business in the streets of Munich, of Dresden, of Hamburg, of Berlin, were beaten, spit upon, and cursed. Jewish children were not allowed to attend the public schools. By the Nuremberg laws of 1935, the Jews were declared to be third-class citizens and were not granted the protections of the law. Jewish artists could not be hung, Jewish musicians could not be heard. The hooligans danced around the bonfires of books by Jewish authors. Every man who joined the Nazi Party, including Herr Kiesinger, had to write down his family tree and to prove that it was Aryan, German, pure, that had borne no taint of the accursed race. In November of 1938, Kristallnacht, synagogues of Germany went up in flames. During this entire seven-year period, Jewish businesses were Aryanized, appropriated. And Mr. Kiesinger did not see, or rather he did not choose to see, as many millions of Germans did not choose to see, anything but their need to advance up the German ladder of success. Kiesinger's desire to advance up the ladder of success in the Foreign Office. Are they not guilty? Are they not guilty of blindness? Is he not guilty of a lack of simple humanity? But then perhaps Mr. Kiesinger was one of those Germans who did not consider the Jews to be human. Those who watched from the sidewalk as the SA and SS toughs manhandled Jewish children and old men and women in the streets. Those who watched, and those who joined the Nazi Party having seen, are surely guilty in the eyes of God, if not under the laws of the Federal Republic of West Germany. Zachor et Amalek. Now the point is made that more than half of the Germans today were underage during the Hitler period, and that half of these again have been born since the end of the Second World War. Surely these are innocent of the German crimes, and they are, of course. But are they innocent of the prejudices and of the passions of their fathers? I wonder. On the 6th of November of this year, during the elections in the state of Hesse, the National Democratic Party, a weird collection of ex-Nazi and neo-Nazi elements, polled over 10% of the vote, 200,000 votes. And by the testimony of a cabinet member of the Bonn government, Well over 60% of these votes were cast by young people under the age of 30. The manifesto of the National Democratic Party reads, point 9, 20 years after the war, we demand an end to one-sided trials which aim at wiping out the past, while in other countries, millions of war crimes against German women and children go unpunished. Point 10 of the same manifesto demands, and I quote, an end to the lie about sole German responsibility, whereby thousands and millions of money has been extracted from our people. November 20th, 2 weeks later, this party which denies the guilt of the Nazis even, and which looks upon reparation money as a forced and unjust extraction, polled over 10% of the vote in another state election in Bavaria, 760,000 votes. And again, by testimony of the German government itself, over 60% of this vote was cast by young people under the age of 30. The next day, the leader of the National Democratic Party announced that he would use this springboard to precipitate his party into the national limelight. The next day, Franz Josef Strauss, who may very well be the defense minister in the new grand coalition of Mr. Kiesinger, said of this election, quote, this is an answer to all those who have tried to pull Germany through the dust, end of quote. A week later, just a week ago, swastikas and slogans, Jews out of Germany, were painted on a monument for Jewish victims in the Memorial Cemetery, Dachau. Zachor et Amalek. Remember what Amalek did unto thee, thou shalt not forget it. Kiesinger's election and these Hessen-Bavarian votes are evidence of a past which has been buried, not forgotten, of passions which have gone underground, but which still burn. And the issue is not simply the issue of anti-Semitism, of the instability of what remains of the German Jewish community. The community is almost gone. It numbered 600,000 before the war. It numbers less than 25,000 today. Hitler did his work all too well. Germany is only the next step away from being Judenrein, cleansed, as he liked to put it, of his Jews. The issue is not anti-Semitism. The issue is world peace. For the swastika and anti-Semitism are the large symbols of German nationalism, of German ambition. That nationalism and that ambition which twice in the lifetime of many of you here plunged the world into suicidal bloodshed. Now, the Germany of 1966 is not the Germany of 30 years ago. It is more or less a democracy. It permits freedom of political expression. There are in Germany today some men of conscience and of sensitivity who, shocked by the evidence of the last 30 years, are seeking desperately to renew the soul of the German people. The so-called German miracle has given Germany a measure of prosperity, and with that prosperity has come a measure of calm. Germany is today is not the Germany of 30 years ago, but it is not a new Germany. The old Germany breathes. It's alive. and it's to a certain degree power. Political, territorial ambition remains the focal policy of the German people. We call it reunification. Now, reunification does not mean simply the unification of East and West Germany, of Bonn and of Pankow. According to official German doctrine, and doctrine agreed upon in Bonn and agreed upon by every one of the major German political parties, the reunified Germany is the Germany of 1937, the Germany of the Sudetenland, that is of Czechoslovakia, the Germany of the lands beyond the Oder-Neisse rivers, the Germany which has gobbled up a good bit of Poland. Political ambition remains the number one focus of German policy. It will not live with dismemberment. Although the concept of a German people and of united Germany is a relatively new one in history. And not only will it not live with the two governments which were imposed by the Allies at the end of the Second World War, but they insist that a reunified Germany must include lands which were taken into Germany by Hitler at the beginning of his stride into power. That the Germany of 1937 is the fatherland is taught in every history text, in every public school in Germany. And that there can be no peace in Europe until this reunification has been established is the official policy of every political party in Germany today. One wonders. One wonders how long the leaders of the Volk and the leaders of the fatherland will continue to speak in terms which sound acceptable to the West. For reunification is masked today as something which will be achieved by broader East-West trade relationships, as something which can be achieved within the ambit of an economic union of all of Europe. It will not so be achieved. Russia will not allow it so to be achieved. And one wonders at what point, what will be the flashpoint in German political life, when its leaders and its major parties will no longer speak in terms of time, economic ties, larger solutions, will revert to the ambition and the militarism of their fathers. And I remind you today that the German army, 450,000 strong, is the second largest army on the continent of Europe, second only to the Russians. That it is sponsored by the third largest industrial complex in the world. That it is equipped with the most modern and sophisticated weapons that the United States can provide. That its aircraft teams and its missile crews are trained to manage nuclear weapons. Though the United States maintains the actual control of these weapons, most crucially, that in August and September of this last year, we saw the first attempt by the high command of the Bundeswehr to free themselves of civilian controls. By the German Constitution of the late 1940s, the military was made subordinate to the civilian government. Never again was the army to be the dominant element in German life. But in late summer of this year, claiming that civilian control meant inefficiency and lack of preparation, a number of generals tried to push through the independence of the German military. They failed. How often will they fail? This is not the hour or the time to forget Amalek. Much more needs to be proven by the German people before they stand clean in the eyes of the world. Let them for a generation or two be of the apostles of peace, the builders of civilization. Then let man review their guilt. This is not the time for forgiveness forgetfulness. It is the time for the United States to review carefully every request of the West German government for arms buildup. This is the time for the United States to deny to Germany its desires to participate in a nuclear force. This is the time for the United States to recognize that all of the pressure that it is, all of the materiel and all of the men that it is throwing into Southeast Asia is weakening its controls over Germany and Europe. And that until proven otherwise, Germany remains the threat to the peace of Europe and to the threat to the peace of the world. This is the time for the American government to admit to itself what it has not admitted, that the Berlin Wall and the Iron Curtain are the kinds of walls that make good neighbors and make for peace in the world. And rather than seeking to tear them down, we ought to be happy that they are there. This is the time for the United States government to cease encouraging Bonn and its hopes of reunification of its territorial ambitions, ambitions which we have made elemental in our own national policy. To tell Bonn what every government in the 20th century must be told, that its challenges are internal, its revolution should be economic, and its progress should be the economic progress and prosperity and justice of its own people. Germany has enough to do and more in refashioning and reformulating the very basis of its national life, not worrying about taking in East Germany or the Sudetenland or Polish lands into the fatherland. One prays that there will be a new Germany. One prays that somehow the Germans will come to grips with their school system, which is still so heavily authoritarian, which still graduates only 6% of its children into full citizenship, which still ceases to humanize and to make the child sensitive to the world about him, to other feelings, to grades and shadings of truth and falsehood rather than to the black and the white. One prays that the Germans will transform their economic miracle into a social miracle, and that their caste-ridden society, with so many layers of degrees and of officialdom, will become open to those who have advanced up the economic scale, that all may feel himself equal, that there will be no Führer and no Lumpen proletariat, no leader and no poor who must unite against the bourgeoisie, the middle class. One prays that the German political machine will have the courage to subordinate its military to its own defense and to its own needs. One prays that the politicians of Germany will nurture democracy in their land. It is a new, still very, very fragile bud. There's not firm rooting there, and it will need nurturing, tender husbanding and care. One prays that there will be a new Germany. And I, for one, pray that the world will remember that this is as yet not the new Germany. That we will remember Amalek. Remember that this is a nation whom the world had to unite to defeat. That we have still political control over a defeated nation. That these controls must still be used to maintain the peace of our world.